I'd like you to keep Matthew 14, 22 through 36 there in mind, the story there about Jesus walking on the water and Peter walking on the water, at least for a little bit. The worshiping of Jesus and then also the healing, these miraculous healings that followed. Keep that in mind now as we turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 28. In 2 Chronicles 28, we read the account of an evil king. And I want you to keep Matthew 14 in mind, and perhaps, in many indeed, other passages that speak very explicitly of Jesus that you might quickly and easily compare and contrast these two kings. King Jesus to hear King Ahaz, 2 Chronicles 28. Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. And he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as his father David had done. But he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. He even made metal images for the Baals, and he made offerings in the valley of the son of Hinnom and burned his sons as an offering, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. And he sacrificed and he made offerings on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. Therefore, the Lord his God gave him into the hand of the king of Syria, who defeated him and took captive a great number of his people and brought them to Damascus. He was also given into the hand of the king of Israel, who struck him with great force. For Pekah, the son of Remaliah, killed 120,000 from Judah in one day, all of them men of valor, because they had forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers. And Zichri, a mighty man from Ephraim, killed Maaseiah, the king's son, and Azrikam, the commander of the palace, and Elkanah, the next in authority to the king. The men of Israel took captive 200,000 of their relatives, women, sons, and daughters. They also took much spoil from them and brought the spoil to Samaria. But a prophet of the Lord was there, whose name was Oded. And he went out to meet the army that came to Samaria and said to them, "Behold, because the Lord, the God of your fathers, was angry with Judah, he gave them into your hand. But you have killed them in a rage that has reached up to heaven. And now you intend to subjugate the people of Judah and Jerusalem, male and female, as your slaves. Have you not sins of your own against the Lord your God? Now hear me, and send back the captives from your relatives whom you have taken, for the fierce wrath of the Lord is upon you." Certain chiefs also of the men of Ephraim, Azariah the son of Jehohanan, Berechiah the son of Meshilamoth, Jehezekiah the son of Shalom, and Amasa the son of Hodlai, stood up against those who were coming from the war, and said to them, "You shall not bring the captives in here, for you propose to bring upon us guilt against the Lord, in addition to our present sins and guilt. For our guilt is already great, and there is fierce wrath against Israel." So the armed men left the captives and the spoil before the princes and all the assembly. And the men who have been mentioned by name rose and took the captives, and with the spoil they clothed all who were naked among them. They clothed them, gave them sandals, provided them with food and drink, and anointed them. And carrying all the feeble among them on donkeys, they brought them to their kinsfolk at Jericho, the city of palm trees. Then they returned to Samaria. At that time, King Ahaz sent to the king of Assyria for help, for the Edomites had again invaded and defeated Judah and carried away captives. And the Philistines made raids on the cities in the Shephelah and the Negeb of Judah, and had taken Beth Shemesh, Ajalon, Gederoth, Soko with its villages, Timnah and with its villages, and Gimzo with its villages. And they settled there. For the Lord humbled Judah because of Ahaz, king of Israel. For he had made Judah act sinfully, and he had been very unfaithful to the Lord. So Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came against him and afflicted him instead of strengthening him. For Ahaz took a portion from the house of the Lord and the house of the king and of the princes and gave tribute to the king of Assyria. But it did not help him. In the time of his distress, he became yet more faithless to the Lord, this same King Ahaz, for he sacrificed to the gods of Damascus that had defeated him and said, because the gods of the kings of Syria helped them, I will sacrifice to them that they may help me. But they were the ruin of him and of all Israel. And Ahaz gathered together the vessels of the house of God and cut in pieces the vessels of the house of God. And he shut up the doors on the house of the Lord and made himself altars in every corner of Jerusalem. In every city of Judah he made high places to make offerings to other gods, provoking to anger the Lord, the God of his fathers. Now the rest of his acts and all his ways from first to last, behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. And Ahaz slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city in Jerusalem, for they did not bring him into the tombs of the kings of Israel. And Hezekiah his son reigned in his place. So as I say, an enormous contrast between Jesus as king and King Ahaz. We could spend all evening making these contrasts between the two. Ahaz doesn't even come close. Ahaz is on the total other end of the spectrum in terms of righteousness. There's not a single thing that he does here that is worthy of mention, of saying, well, at least there was that thing. At every single point, he seems addicted to destruction, addicted to idolatry, clinging to the very things that are ruining him. And on top of that, Ahaz is plunging into all kinds of death and sin and misery, his own people, his country, everyone he comes in contact with. Those he is supposed to care for, lift up, and serve in the name of the Lord, he is ruining. He is sending into battles that are lost. He is putting them in terrible places. And sadly, they're following him in all of this. They're following him in the idolatry. They're following him in the false worship, as people often do of their leaders. They follow them. This is so different from Jesus. What happens to Peter there in Matthew 14 when he follows Jesus, when he comes after him? Success. He walks on water. What happens when he doubts? He drowns in the water. It's the same thing here in 2 Chronicles. It's emphasizing this point. The one who was to reign as king under God is to follow after the Lord. Success when doing so, and failure when not. One of the reasons I believe God gives us these histories and tells us these stories in such rich detail, instead of just making, you know, perhaps a couple theological points for us to reflect on, though that would be very valuable in itself, I believe that he gives us these stories to color in these truths, to impress them on our hearts, and to remind us how life works in full color, in high definition. On top of that, God tells us these things to remind us the very truthfulness of the things that he says, the things that he commands us to do, the ways that he expresses himself to us. These are not abstractions. They're not just big ideas and plans that God has. They are the wisdom in which the world has been made. They're the system in which we are working and living. It's the air we breathe. It's who we are. As those who have been made in God's image, made to reflect his glory, to follow after him. When we don't do that, even as our first parents failed to do that, we plunge ourselves into ruin. So let's consider the story. Let's call some of its details to our attention. I want you to see the extreme nature of Ahaz's idolatry. The way in which he clings to it over and over again. You remember Jotham, his father, it was quite the opposite. We read in the beginning of 2 Chronicles 27 that Jotham, verse 2, did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. This was the great summary verse of Jotham's rule and his reign. Ahaz, not the case. We begin this account. The chronicler begins by saying he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as his father David had done. And this is one of the uses of father here that can doesn't mean immediate father, because that, of course, is Jotham, but father meaning several generations back, a grandfather, a great-great-great-grandfather. Why does he mention David? Because you remember that all of these events in Israel and Judah are happening in the context of God's covenant with David. We are all waiting in this flow of the history for this promised son. This promised son who would come to David. So here, with each successive king, we are supposed to be asking, is this the one? Is this the one? Like children impatiently in the back of the car. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? We're clearly not there yet. With Ahaz, the son of David, he is not walking in the ways of his father. He's not trusting in the Lord. He's not fearing in the Lord. In fact, he walks in the ways of the kings of Israel. Now, if you're coming into this new, it's important to remember that at this point, Israel and Judah are two countries, in a sense, that have been split. A split in the family of God. Judah in the south, Israel in the north. David, under David and under Solomon, they were one united kingdom. However, when they split, bad things happened, especially in the north. We've been tracing, by and large, the history of the southern kingdom, the history of the kings of Judah, where God's promise is ongoing. In many ways, Israel in the north, though technically relatives, as we see in this chapter, are in many ways not following after the Lord anymore. They are almost as another, just a pagan country. Why? Because of the idolatry. At the very beginning of the departure of Israel from God's people, it happened because they set up false idols. They set up false gods. They instituted false worship, and that has been, for the most part, been carrying on all this time. So that's why the chronicler says he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. He's sort of attaching him to this other country and this other people that have gone far astray and have already for many generations. Very interestingly, in verse 19, it says, "For the Lord humbled Judah because of Ahaz, king of Israel." He's not technically king of Israel. He's king of Judah. That's why God is humbling Judah, because of the actions of their king. But he's being characterized now here in a second way as the king of this other country. Why? Because he's acting in that way. You know, we have this phrase, you know, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's a duck. And that's what Ahaz is doing. He's not walking like a son of David. He's walking like the son, rebellious sons of David, like the kings of Israel. So this is how the chronicler introduces this man to us. And then he tells us the extent of his idolatry. He begins in verse 2 there saying he even made metal images for the Baals. One of the ways we see Ahaz's idolatry is in the number of gods that he goes to serve. Not only is he failing to serve the one true God and is giving worship to false images, to demons, he gives worship to many of them. The number of his, or the amount in this sense, the number of idols and idolatry and places of worship is repeated over and over again in this chapter. It's a way of showing the extent of his idolatry. Even here in the very first verse, the introduction to this idea, he even made metal images for the Baals. It goes on then in verse 4 and says, he sacrificed and made offerings on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. This is how the chapter begins, and then from there it sort of flows out and we see the consequences of that action. And then amazingly, we see at the end of all of this, instead of him turning in repentance, instead of him learning from his sins and the punishment and the wrath of God on him, he does the exact same thing again. Remember verse 22? In his time of distress, he became yet more faithless to the Lord, this same King Ahaz. Now we see him in verse 23 sacrificing to the gods of Damascus, the ones that have defeated him. Then we see him not only worshiping these other gods, but even shutting down true worship in Israel. He's not just multiplying false worship, he's shutting down the possibility for true worship. Ahaz, verse 24, gathers together the vessels of the house of God. That means he goes into the temple and takes the lampstand and takes the bowl. He's getting all of these things that had been made by Solomon, that God had given specific instructions for, that were modeled after the tabernacle that had also been specifically called for by God. Ahaz goes into the house of God, cuts them to pieces of the house of God, shuts the doors, locks them up, and then establishes altars all around Jerusalem. You see what he's doing here. And then it goes and says from verse 25, in every city of Judah, he made high places to make offerings to other gods. What territory has he not touched? What amount of corruption has not been established? Where has the poison not reached in Judah? Ahaz seems focused, intent on establishing worship over and against God. Where does this get him? Where does his direct and immediate idolatry get him? Verse 5, therefore, the Lord his God gave him into the hand of the king of Syria, who defeated him and took a great number of his people captive and brought them to Damascus. One of the great themes that we've been seeing in Chronicles is that as the kings do well, the land is secured, the borders are made strong, the people are safe. The opposite of that is what we see here. When the king fails to follow the Lord, the land starts breaking apart. The people start dying. Foreign enemies begin to take over. The strength of Israel begins to die. And this is what happens. This Syrian king comes and takes them and defeats them. But more than that, he's also, we read in verse 5, given into the hand of the king of Israel. Again, now in a sense, a foreign army, a foreign force coming in and takes them. Indeed, not only do they kill many men of war, but then Israel, in their wickedness, decides to take it a step further. This is, of course, the great nature of wickedness, of sinfulness, It always wants more. Always wants more. That's why I described it at the beginning as a kind of addiction to idolatry. That's what sin is. And when it's in your heart that way, it just pulls you further and further down. And Israel's the same way. They're not satisfied with the fact that the Lord has given them this great victory in battle. They want to take these people captive. Not just the army, but their relatives. And here we're reminded of that connection between Judah and Israel. That's why I made sure to give some historical background there. Women, sons, and daughters. And they seek to bring it to Samaria. What happens next? The Lord sends a prophet, Oded, who goes out and says, "Stop! Stop! Desist! You're doing a bad thing. First of all, remember that these are your relatives." We won't have time to go into it, but throughout the Old Testament, there are all kinds of laws dealing with how people ought to relate to one another in as children of Abraham. And there are rules concerning what you can and cannot do, even in terms of slavery and debts and other things, and war as well. Anyway, they're going against these principles here. They intended to subjugate these people, to make them their slaves, like they might make slaves of a foreign power. But he tells them, he says, "Don't do this. Don't do this." He reminds them of their nature as relatives, but he also says, "This didn't happen because you're just greatly successful in battle. The reason you have this victory is because God is punishing them and giving them into your hand. But you have killed them in a rage that has reached up to heaven." He then goes on to say, Have you not sins of your own against the Lord your God?" You see the kind of pastoral prophetic logic there? He says to them, he says that these people here, these brothers and sisters of yours, have been judged for doing the same things you are doing and have done. What do you think you should do now, right? Should you learn from the beating of a fool? The answer is yes, you should. God gives us these warnings and these examples to wake us up. Pause. It's for us too, right? We can't stand here and look at Ahaz and Judah like Israel tried to do. No, we have to ask the same questions. Have we committed these same sins? Are we to be held accountable for the same kinds of idolatry? Now, perhaps some of us have fallen into this kind of direct and immediate idolatry, setting up images, bowing to graven images, and other things. But perhaps it's indirect as well, and Ahaz is also guilty of this. We see this after all of this falls out in verse 16. Ahaz decides to get help. He goes to the king of Assyria. Of course, where could his help come from? The Lord. The Lord God, his Lord God, the one who has been able to accomplish all of these things. But instead, he, of course, doesn't have his eyes on the Lord. Instead, he trusts in a kind of indirect idolatry in this king of Assyria. The Edomites had again attacked, the Philistines were making raids, everything was falling apart. And so what does he do? He goes into the house of the Lord. He goes into the things that belong in a very direct and immediate way to God. He goes to the temple of God. And we read in verse 21, and he takes a portion from it. He takes the wealth that belongs to them. And he also takes wealth from the house of the king and of the princes, and he gives it to the king of Assyria. Right? So now instead of bowing down and giving tribute to the Baals and the whatever else he did, he also now goes to the king of Assyria. He gives him this tribute as a vassal king. He who is under the king of the universe now places himself under this foreign power. But it did not help him. Of course it didn't. So what happened? Assyria comes in and destroys them. This is a very clear warning against idolatry. This whole chapter is telling us in many, many ways the dangerous path which we get on when we do not trust in the Lord, but we trust in false gods and images of our own making. When we trust in men, in riches, in horses, in chariots, when we trust in technology of any sort, be it old or new, when we trust in our power, when we trust in our status, when we trust in our rank, these things do not secure us, as Ahaz should have learned and never did. So, I have just a simple question for you this evening. As you evaluate yourself in your own heart before the Lord, are you clinging to things? Are you trusting in things other than Him? As I say, some idolatry is very direct. Worshipping images, worshipping false gods. But other times it's indirect. We hide our idolatry. We don't make it quite so open and prominent. Are there things in your life that you keep coming back to, even to your own ruin? Over and over and over again, despite the fact that it's ruining you, despite the fact that it's hurting you and the people around you, you keep coming back again and again. Maybe it's sexual immorality, maybe it's anger, maybe it's discontentment, maybe it's pride. The basis of all of these things, though, is a sort of core idolatry. Looking for things and hope and satisfaction and pleasure and justice and truth outside of the God from whom all these things come. Are there things in your life that you keep coming back to, even to your ruin? As you name these things, let 2 Chronicles 28 be a warning to you. To see, to use a phrase I heard someone else use recently, play that tape to the end. That's what 2 Chronicles 28 does. It shows you how these things lead, where they go, the final result. They end in death. They end in ruin. Peter experienced this in a very visceral way when he's walking on the water and he lets go. He takes his eyes off the Lord. He looks elsewhere. He becomes more afraid of the wind and the water and of his weakness than of the strength of Jesus. And what happens? He starts to sink. He goes down into death, chaos, tragedy. But passages of warning are also given to us to be a blessing, and they can be a blessing to us. When we lift our eyes up to Jesus, when we lift our eyes up to the King who has done all things well, who has established all good things, when we lift our eyes up away from our autonomy, from our wicked desires, our wanting to live in our own way and trust in our own things, but we lift them up to the God who is and who has come in Jesus Christ himself, and we lift them up not to an idol of our own making, but to Jesus. And by faith, trust in him, we find salvation. We hear Jesus saying, "It is I. Do not be afraid." Because Jesus is capable. His disciples found that out on the boat. when Peter is there walking on the water and the winds are calmed and everything's quiet, it clicked. And instead of worshiping anything else, the wind, the sea, themselves, some false god, their boat, their business, they worship Jesus. I hope that in their story, you can see how capable he is. That Jesus is able to take hold of us and protect us. He is the one who has been sent by the God who is controlling all these events in 2 Chronicles 28. These stories are not disconnected. Jesus is the great covenant Lord of his people. He is the one to whom Ahaz was called to bend the knee. He is the one that promised goodness and blessing to them, the one that they refused. In the next several chapters of 2 Chronicles, we'll read about a very great king, Hezekiah. And what Hezekiah does is he tries to undo, and he does it very successfully, all that his father had done. And one of the things Hezekiah does is he calls to Israel. He calls them all and he says to them, "The Lord is compassionate. The Lord is merciful. Do not be stiff-necked like your fathers." It's the same message that I want to give to you tonight. When you hear a passage like Ahaz, or you think of people in your life, or you see the own stubbornness of your heart when it comes to sins, hear the message of God. Don't be stiff-necked. Don't cross your arms and just sink into the water. Instead, reach out to Jesus. Tell him, "I'm afraid, I'm scared, but I'm going to trust in you." Because Jesus is able to take hold of us. Jesus is able to protect us. And so we ought to worship him and him alone. May God grant us that kind of faith and the kind of honesty that is required to say those kinds of things, to admit when we're scared, to admit when we're doubting, to admit when we're fearful or clinging to evil things, but to go to him and confess it and trust that he's not only powerful, but he's also powerful in his grace and that he will hold us up and take care of us. Let's pray and ask that God would bless us with those very things.